Tout le monde, il veut seulement la thune. Et seulement ça, ça les fait parler. Tout le monde, il veut seulement la thune.
Tout le monde, il veut seulement la thune.
Et seulement ça, ça les fait parler.
Hi, Alison.
Hi, Sarah. So the big topic in France these days is the budget.
Yeah.
I know it doesn't sound very sexy, but the planned cuts to public spending will have a very tangible impact on life here in France.
That's true. That's true. And the government is going at this very carefully because the previous government, right, this is Prime Minister Michel Barnier, fell after its budget was seen as too drastic.
Yeah, because France has a 60 billion euro deficit and Barnier's proposal involved 40 billion of cuts to public spending and 20 billion raised through tax hikes, for example, on big companies, very high earners. The new government wants to survive a bit longer than the 3 months that Barnier did, so it's revised its targets down a bit. Now they're proposing spending cuts of up to 32 billion and raising 21 billion in income through taxes.
Yeah, so the budget has passed through both houses of parliament, and today, Thursday, goes to a joint committee for further discussion in order to try to get this thing passed.
Yeah, most ministries will be impacted by these cuts, but not defence. We need strong armed forces in these very uncertain times, the government argues.
And of course, besides the you know, clear outcry over education and health cuts, which will be drastic and impacting already fragile systems, there's also outcry elsewhere. For example, the world of sports, they're very unhappy. Last week, 30 sports personalities wrote an open letter complaining that France was reneging on all these good things that came out of the Summer Olympics. Then you have culture, you know, just when the Louvre Museum is apparently falling apart.
Yeah, apparently, because last week the head of the Louvre alerted to the lamentable state of the museum, saying it really is in a dire state.
Yeah.
President Macron, who visited it this week, has some ideas. For example, making non-EU visitors pay more to enter. Why not?
Okay.
Also having separate tickets just to see the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
As so many people do.
Right.
Meanwhile, the big renovation plan probably will involve calling on rich benefactors, a bit like they did for Notre Dame. So, à suivre.
Amène-moi, amène-moi, là où tu vas, là où tu vas, viens pas les mains. Bafangagem, si ma mingue d'or loco, Bafangagem, ah, ah, ah.
Now, Sarah, one area that stands to be hit very hard by these budget cuts is public development assistance, sometimes known as PDA or ODA.
Ah, so this is like funding development programs around the world, I guess, especially in poorer countries.
Yeah, and their budget, which depends on the foreign ministry, is being literally slashed.
Mm.
The initial plan that was announced last year was to cut France's PDA by 1.4 billion euros, but then the Senate agreed to increase those cuts to more than 2 billion euros. So that's about 35% of the existing budget.
Mm.
MPs and senators on the left are outraged about this, but even some from the centre and on the right are also concerned that this would fly in the face of France's commitments.
Right. I mean, back in June 2023, Macron hosted a global climate finance summit in Paris, and he promised that low-income countries and vulnerable populations would not have to choose between fighting poverty and fighting climate change.
And before that, back in 2021, France signed into law a pledge to reach the UN's target of spending 0.7% of its gross national income on aid by 2025. Today, if these cuts go through, then that aid will in fact go down to 0.45% of gross national income.
Right, so not exactly moving towards these goals.
Not exactly. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs has tried to justify these cuts, insisting they're not disproportionate, but French NGOs working in development at the international level are unsurprisingly very worried. On Wednesday, Coordination Sud, that's an umbrella group of 180 French NGOs working internationally, gathered outside the National Assembly to defend international solidarity and call on the MPs and senators meeting today to rethink those drastic cuts. I spoke to Elodie Barallon, in charge of advocacy with the group, about their concerns, which include the grinding down of civil society here in France.
We understand everyone has to make an effort, and that's not the point. It's rather the proportion has taken on ODA. the development assistance is being cut by nearly 40% of this budget, which is huge compared to any other public service budget. And the budget for assistance, humanitarian development, human rights defenders are shrinking. When the crises are more and more, their impact is significantly higher, especially on women and children, and the most vulnerable people's needs are not met.
Can you give us some concrete examples?
Globally, we have been made aware we have only one planet, one health. COVID made that very obvious. So if we stop helping the health system, nutrition system, defending the rights across the borders, supporting people who have to leave certain countries because of a crisis, because of war, especially women and children who are most affected and impacted by those critical situations. This is not improving. It has actually worsened, and we're stepping back. France is stepping back on the international scene as well. We have made commitment as a country, especially as a human rights defender country.
Yeah, because France in 2021 signed into law a commitment to spend 0.7% of its gross domestic income on development aid, right?
We had been on a slowly but steady increase since 2021, achieving 0.55 in 2023. That was quite encouraging, though it was never fast enough for us. But now, with the current cut being envisaged, we would step back 7 years ago in terms of what the ODA would be for France. So way below the 2021 law expectations and targets, but also way below the needs globally and for every partner in international solidarity action.
We're also talking about economic impacts here in France.
Yeah, there are also impacts in France on the sector, because many organizations will see their most reliable so far funding being cut by nearly half. That means some of the member organizations of Coordination Sud are already considering redundancy plans and perhaps also closing down if it goes that far.
Job losses, rising unemployment.
Yeah. And that is critical considering the amount of people being hired in the sector, but also all the expertise, because these cuts is also very political. It's not recognizing civil society's expertise and recognizing the role our organizations have in leading this major impactful action on humanity, basically.
So are you suggesting that the government is also trying to take back control of certain things and diminish the influence that civil society has?
Well, to me, these cuts is also in a wider context of the shrinking of civic space. Far-right movements, populist movements also having more of a say and pushing for national fold. And all that put civil society in a place no longer as a counterpower and as a partner, but more of a burden and something that we have to keep quiet. And one way of keeping us quiet is to cut the funding.
Have you had much contact with the decision makers in French Parliament?
I'll say there is a trend for about 2-3 years in a regrettable decrease in the dialogue with the institutions and with the French government. We had difficulties to meet our Minister of Foreign Affairs, for example. We have been requesting an appointment since he's been appointed, and we haven't yet had the chance to have a chat with him. So there is less and less dialogue with civil societies. I think this more democratic way of running the society is slowly crumbling, and the most obvious sign of that is this lack of dialogue.
So by demonstrating here today in front of the National Assembly, I mean, the budget has already been agreed by both houses, but now it's going to be reviewed by a joint commission. What is the message that you're sending out?
This is a negotiation, so we still have space for negotiation. There are two main key messages we want to pass on. The cut on the overseas development assistance is disproportionate. The effort that is being asked to all other budget is much lower. So that's one thing. And we have the solution. So it's not like we have come and just raised our case for more budget, but we also have two dedicated taxes, one on financial transactions and one on air tickets. Jacques Chirac and Nicolas Sarkozy created those taxes. Those had been put in place to support development assistance and to fund it.
So right-wing presidents at the time?
Yeah, and a kind of right-wing solution for a left-wing need, yeah. So to say. And when they created those taxes, they were both meant to be allocated. The current government and the current assembly have agreed that their amount should be slightly higher. According to our estimation, that could raise up to 1.6 billion euros this year. So that's nearly what they want to cut in the yearly budget on development aid. So their amount being increased has been approved. The only thing is not allocated to development assistance yet.
Now, of course, you have your role as activists. The government has its role to handle public funding. And they're saying we absolutely have to get the deficit down. Are there ways in which development aid could perhaps also be better organised to reduce costs?
At the moment, we're in a context that is very, very difficult because all the countries are withdrawing from multinational organisations, right, and they are stepping back on their commitments, especially at the UN level. France is stepping back from international commitments that they have made. So it's not like we can easily tap into other funding sources or other donors, because all of them are under constraint. The needs have increased a lot, and even with a steady increase of French development assistance over the past few years, we were not catching up. So stepping back on the budget at the moment will just create more crisis and send the wrong message internationally as well, because that's something President Macron was quite leading our place in the world as defending human rights and fighting poverty and discrimination. And now we have very strong position, especially over the Atlantic, stepping back in terms of discrimination, inclusion and diversity. And this will just send the wrong message. I think in terms of the political commitment, we are tapping in the wrong budget.
So in a way, it's almost a trend to withdraw from development aid, and therefore France can say, well, listen, guys, we're only doing what everyone else is doing.
This is dramatic in a sense that it also relates to the shrinking of civic space, stepping back on human rights, stepping back on all the commitments that made us such a solidary country towards our peers and as a role model. And these are trends, but they're a trend also translating a more worrying political context of leading more and more discrimination, national fallback, being concentrated on very, very local issues when we are all interdependent and what is happening elsewhere will impact us now. So we need to anticipate that and help the most vulnerable ones.
So, Alison, I've heard that development aid is being connected sometimes to migration, the idea that, you know, vulnerable people around the world, if they're not helped at home, you know, could decide to leave and, you know, for example, try to come to France and Europe, which is a sticking point for some on the right. Is that something being addressed right now with these cuts?
Yeah, well, that is an argument that's being advanced by some politicians. Basically, if you cut down on sending aid to poorer countries, then yes, you'll somehow contribute to massive migration,
right,
here in France. Given that the whole issue of immigration, migration, it's really become a political football here in France and is being sometimes really used by the far right as a way to just, you know, say zero immigration mm-hmm. from now on. Therefore, the NGOs are really reluctant to make that link, all the more so because it's actually very difficult in terms of data to clearly establish the link between development aid and an increase in migration.
Hard to find much to laugh about in the world at the moment, Alison.
No, exactly. Which is why, Sarah, I am delighted to bring to your attention and that of our many, many loyal listeners around the world to the famous French comedian Pierre Dac.
Signé Furac.
He died 50 years ago on the 9th of February. He wasn't just a funny face, although he did look a bit funny. But he was a sort of clown who used his humour to defy Hitler.
C'est la complainte des nazis, le crépuscule avant la nuit, qui met au cœur des Hitlériens l'âpre terreur du lendemain.
So this is one of his songs, La Complainte des Nazis, The Nazis' Lament.
So he was Jewish, right?
Yes, he was. Born André Isaac into an Alsatian Jewish family. He got badly wounded fighting in World War One. He hurt his arm, so he couldn't become a violinist, as he'd hoped. He wrote his first sketches in the trenches. And then once the war was over, he began performing in cabaret. In the 1930s, he produced the first radio comedy programs.
So what kind of humor are we talking about?
Well, this was not satire. He was not taking punches or criticizing the government and this kind of thing. They were not the kind of jokes either that would have maybe made you bend over double with laughing, you know, wet your pants. But he used very witty wordplay, and he was seen really as a master of the absurd. He invented, for example, the word Schmilblick, which is basically an object with a Yiddish name that was utterly useless and therefore could be used for everything. That word is still used in French. He invented another word, loufoque, out of the word fou, meaning crazy. That's a word that stuck too. Overall, he used this kind of invented language to bring out the absurdity of everyday life.
Okay, so he began in cabaret. How did he end up working to undermine the Nazis?
Well, he became a household name doing his absurdist sketches, mainly on private radio stations in the 1930s. And as I said, he wasn't mean, he didn't poke fun at people at all. But then when World War II broke out, he joined the resistance and he used his platform to fight anti-Semitism. He railed against Hitler, Mussolini, any French person who collaborated with the Germans.
Wouldn't have gone down very well with the Vichy regime here in France.
Nope. In fact, he had to leave Paris and he fled to London in 1943, where he worked for Free France's Radio Londres, which was broadcast on the BBC. Dax's show was called Les Français parlent aux Français, the French speak to the French, and it was a direct response to the Vichy regime's propaganda channel, Radio Paris.
Radio Paris, Radio Paris, Radio Paris est allemand.
Radio Paris is lying, Radio Paris is German, he sings, to the tune of La Cucaracha.
So what was his experience in the resistance? I mean, was it just mainly trying to boost morale over the channel?
Well, in 1944, he had a big run-in with the French politician and Nazi collaborator Philippe Henriot, who was also the head of propaganda broadcasts. Henriot attacked Dac and other Jews for abandoning France. He challenged him on air, saying, "What does France represent for you, Dac?" Well, Dac, whose brother had died on the battlefield in 1915, retorted that his brother's grave was marked, "Here lies Marcel Isaac, died for France, age 28, whereas Henriot's grave, if he ever had one, would carry the epitaph, "Here lies Henriot, died for Hitler, executed by a French firing squad."
Not particularly funny.
No, but witty and ominous, it turns out, because shortly after, Henriot was killed by the French resistance.
So what happened to Pierre Dac after the war?
He fell into depression, sadly, and he stopped working for a while. But then he made a comeback as a double act with another popular comedian, Francis Blanche. Together, they created Signé Furax, a blend of science fiction, absurdism and poetry, and it became the most listened to serial in the history of French radio. They also set up a French political party known as Mouvement Ondulatoire Unifié, the Unified Wavy Movement, or MOU for short.
MOU, moo, that means what, soggy or flaccid in French?
It does. And their slogan was, "Times are hard, vote for moo," which I do genuinely find very funny. Anyway, that's just me. In an interview, Dac said, "We live in a very overexcited, nervous era. So we thought it was a good idea to inject a bit of flabbiness." This is Dac and Blanche launching the party in 1959.
Notre parti, parti d'Henri, c'est le parti de tous ceux qui n'ont pas pris de parti.
So to the sounds of Ravel's Bolero, they sing, "It's the party to laugh about. It's the party for people who haven't taken sides.
I see. So, right, this is a play on words between parti, that means political party, and prendre parti, that means to take sides, right?
Thank you, Sarah. You got it. I know, it's tricky, this kind of translation. But Dac ran in the 1965 presidential elections as the head of MOU, and one of his future ministers was to be René Goscinny, the writer of Asterix.
But he didn't win.
He didn't, I regret. In an interview in 1968, he said, "Humour is a wonderful weapon. It allows you to hold out in the most tragic and dramatic circumstances." Now, obviously, he was thinking of the tragedy of World War II, but I can't help thinking it's a shame that he's not here now to inject a bit of flabbiness, flaccidity and a smile in France's current political landscape.
Mais n'ouvre pas le débat. Un gentleman parmi tant d'autres qui vivent autour de toi. Puis c'est cool.
So, Alison, I want to go back now to a story that we covered a couple of years ago in the podcast now. And do you remember when I met some doctors and patients involved in an experiment with medical marijuana in France?
Yeah, it wasn't quite a trial as such, but it was more about how to administer the drug to patients to help them manage with pain and that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So this was back in 2021. Because while cannabis is used medically in many European countries, it has not been authorized in France.
Yeah, marijuana and cannabis are not legal here, recreationally, of course, but not medically either.
Yeah, yeah. And as we talked about before, France still has some of the harshest anti-drug legislation in Europe, even though we have some of the highest levels of marijuana consumption. Go figure. The experiment was meant to show doctors and pharmacists and politicians that this was possible to treat patients with cannabis in a controlled medical setting. So they recruited 3,000 people with severe conditions like multiple sclerosis or chronic pain that wasn't responding to other pain medication. About 1,800 people ended up being involved in the experiment in one form or another. They were prescribed oils, mostly, that contain THC, which is the psychoactive component in marijuana, and CBD in different concentrations. And they would get this once a month.
Right. But that experiment came to an end in 2024.
Yeah, yeah. And the expectations was that it would end with the authorization of medical cannabis in France. The INSM, the National Medication Health Agency, which ran the experiment, started off with the assumption that cannabis could help some of these conditions. And at the end of last year, 2024, it did give authorization for cannabis products to be used medically in France. However, in a turnaround, the government has not moved to make it happen, hasn't approved it going forward.
So which government? That's the question, yeah. Because there's been a bit of chaos in the last several months. We've actually had three governments in the space of a year.
Yeah, so that's been a problem. And this experiment has ended, therefore, without cannabis products being available to patients. Generally, this has left the ones in the trial in a pretty bad situation. Nadine Attal, a neurologist and the head of the pain center in the public hospital in Boulogne, West of Paris, is also a researcher and was involved in the medical cannabis experiment from the beginning. There were 700 people with chronic pain enrolled in the experiment. Her center was following about 20 of them. And she told me that, you know, while she's not a proponent per se of the use of cannabis, the medical literature is still not completely clear on the benefits, but many of her patients really found relief using medical marijuana. And as she points out, this experiment was actually focused more on logistics than anything else.
The initial goal of this experimentation was not even to show the efficacy and safety. The primary objective was to see the feasibility of delivering medical cannabis by primary care physicians and by pharmacists. This part of the trial was, I would say, not 100% met, because in Paris area in particular, most physicians are extremely, extremely busy. So most of them did not reply to our queries. So that means that we were facing patients who were obliged to go back to the pain center every month to get their treatment while they should have gone to the GP. That was one of the problems which we faced in the Paris area. It was a little bit less problematic in other regions in France.
Is it the trial itself or is it the administration of the drug that was kind of complicated, or just they just didn't want to deal with it?
Everything was complicated. The trial, of course, they had to complete questionnaires. They didn't have time for it. And they had to do an e-learning. initial e-learning, which was supposed to be about 2 hours and a half, and actually it was much more. So they didn't even have time to do this e-learning, and some of them were not simply interested.
So that part of the experiment, which was kind of the key, right? It was a little difficult to see how can we logistically get this in place, for example, in Paris. But you said outside of Paris and other places, it worked
and
pretty
pharmacists,
well.
Pharmacists were compensated, but not the GPs. So they did a little bit more, and it was more successful among pharmacists than among primary care physicians in the Paris area. But on the whole, if you look at the general results, it was not negative. It was generally positive. The problem is what is going to happen now.
It seems to have had some success in terms of meeting the goals. The National Medication Agency in France has approved now, has said this is okay. It's even in the law now, a Social Security law that said, okay, we can start selling these products in France. Are we going to see medical marijuana?
You cannot sell this in France. These are plant extracts which were delivered by non-French firms, Canadian, Israel also, because in these countries cannabis is extensively used. And now we have received very difficult information a few weeks ago that the experiment had to go to an end. That means that we have to stop the treatment for these patients. We have 6 months to do so. Mm-hmm. So we have to taper off very progressively the drugs. But the patients, some of them are extremely emotional about it. Some of them are completely more shocked than doctors, of course, and they're extremely emotional. I have now, they are coming back to the pharmacies, weeping, crying. Some of them say, what are we going to do?
It makes sense that an experiment comes to an end, but it seems like this experiment came to an end at the end of 2024 with some steps forward to make it possible and open to everyone. What are the sticking points? France has obviously political chaos right now, but beyond that, like what's the sticking point?
I think there are two reasons. The first is the price of the drugs. There is no social security because this is not exactly it doesn't have exactly the status of a medical treatments like opiates, for instance. And the second reason is probably political. As you said, it's a little bit messy because we have now, I think, the seventh Minister of Health over the past 2 years. What is terrible? That's the French problem. We did a very sophisticated experimentation. It is more sophisticated than all the experimentations that took place in any other countries, from the beginning to the end. And now, over. This is France.
In a way, what you're saying is it's done very well, and then afterwards there's no follow-up.
Exactly. And so it seems impossible now to expand the experimentation, which was one of the goals. However, we have to be compassionate. A subgroup of the patients who were initially enrolled, these were 700 patients, and some of these patients have stopped. So probably we are left with about 200, 300, I don't know exactly, in France, who want to continue. It's nearly nothing at the scale of the France when you consider that there are about 5% of the French population has neuropathic pain. For these patients, probably 200 or 300 patients that are still pleased and happy with our cannabis should be allowed to go on. I think the authorities should make an effort to give them the possibility at least to continue.
So it sounds like right now you have shifted your focus from at the beginning of this saying this will be something that we can roll out to everyone. That's not even a possibility anymore. You just are focusing on the patients that you're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to be realistic. Apparently, the politicians are not ready. Okay, they're not ready. That's one problem. They should be ready, but they're not. But the second problem is that we have these patients now. What are we going to do with them? That's unethical. You cannot forget these patients. I understand that they consider that there are much more urgencies, like the medical system, the social security, everything. It is much more urgent than 300 patients. But on the other side, these 300 patients would not cost that much. So, of course, it's less urgent on a general idea. But there should be a possibility to at least not stop everything.
What happened? Was this experimentation put in place like too early in this sort of political scheme? Was it done too soon in France?
No, it was not too early. I think it was the good moment because we had so many other registries or experimentations from other countries, including European countries. So we were very late. And so it was our turn to be modern and to do what we had to do. I mean, this was a very good initiative. I don't think that cannabis is a good treatment for everyone. Far from it. And I also think that we need good randomized controlled trials. That's another issue. Since this had been this decision, I think when you do something, you do it to the end. You don't stop abruptly, as we do now.
Yeah, so on some level, you feel like you were sort of like kind of brought into something that wasn't, that you're now stuck having to deal with these patients who are anxious and sad and angry.
Myself, of course, I feel concerned. I feel empathetic for those patients, but my medical colleagues are extremely shocked. This is something which concerns very, very problematic patients. Some of them have spinal cord injury, post-stroke pain. They are handicapped. They are disabled. This should have been planned from the very beginning. What are we going to do when the experimentation stops?
Is that a question you asked at the beginning?
Yes, of course. We were certain 2 years ago, 3 years ago, that there would be a possibility of generalization. There were lobbies also, there were people that were involved in it. But what can we do? I mean, there are not so many politicians who are very interested in it because we have more urgencies. I can understand that. It's not an urgency from an economical perspective or whatever, but it's an emergency for these patients. We're dealing with human beings. I do hope we can find a solution for them without even thinking of a generalization. We are not ready for it. Okay, but at least do something for these patients.
So, a lot of people in a state of limbo there.
Mm-hmm.
What are the options for these people and people in general who are maybe hoping to be able to use medical cannabis?
Well, it's really not clear. So, of course, some of these patients will go back to smoking joints as they were doing before with all of the potential negative health impacts that has and, you know, not exactly legal. The legalization itself is stalled on the level of implementation, right? So there's no French producer of medical cannabis products. The foreign products are expensive. There's no mechanism currently for it to be reimbursed by the public health system. It really is all in a standstill. And politicians are definitely upping the tone on the, you know, war on drugs these days. Not exactly open to the idea of legalizing any form of marijuana anytime soon.
Mon spliff, mon pédo, mon ange de IHK, mon nif, la fumée de mon cali ou de ma cannabis.
And we've come to the end of the show. This episode was mixed by Cécile Pompeani.
Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International. And if you'd like to send us a message, please write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. We'd love to hear from you.
And we're on Instagram too, Spotlight on France. We'll be back with a new show in 2 weeks on Thursday, February 13th. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah.
Et la petite canne, le cannabis, la petite bise, le soi-disant.